This is a KSHSAA production.
First down from the 17 is where they mark it officially. Here's Hancock, breaks back at the 15, 10, 5, touchdown, Jayden Hancock.
One block down to the other end, misses. Shot won't go up the gun. And Eudora comes from way behind and goes crazy.
All right, welcome to episode 5 of the KSHSAA podcast. This is a special episode as we will concentrate on one topic for this episode, and that is the Fall Regional Administrator and Board of Education meetings that are coming up Monday, October 20th. What this meeting is about is there are topics for discussion where administrators will get together in front of Gary Musselman and discuss certain questions in regards to certain sports, as to a yes or no vote as to whether they think these questions or rules changes should be adopted by the association. And in doing that, we'll get a better understanding of the governance of the KSHSAA as we talk with Gary about the agenda and why exactly we have these regional meetings. So just one topic to cover here on the episode this week, but a very important one. So listeners all throughout Kansas can understand how things and rules and ideas get changed here in the Association for High School Activities. A quick look at the calendar will show us that state tennis is October 17th and 18th. That is this weekend as I'm talking. So be tuned to our score center at Keisha.org for the results from those tournaments. To go over the schedule for those regional meetings that we will go over here in a minute or two, just remember, administrators, please just bring your ADM5 attendance card to these meetings. On Monday, October 20th, the meeting will be here in Topeka. And on October 21st, Fort Scott. The 22nd, Shawnee Mill Valley High School. The 23rd, Salinas Central. And then the next Monday, October 27th, be at Oakley High School. And October 28th, we'll go out to Dodge City at the USD 443 Learning Center. And to wrap it up, October 29th, we'll be at Mays High School. So to preview the agenda and bring up the topics of discussion and give the rationales for why these questions are being asked to these administrators, we sat down with Gary Musselman.
Okay, Gary, as we go into this next week here, October, starting with October 20th, we're going to go into Board of Educational Regional Administrative Meetings. Just kind of give us some insight of what the purpose and the process is of that as how it lays out in the Keisha structure.
Okay. The regional meetings, short term for the more lengthy title you described, is the Regional Administrator Board of Education Meetings, are really kind of grassroots. They're conducted every fall, usually the last half of October. They're really a kind of an extension of the executive board. And I explain them to people as almost a listening tour of our member schools across the state of Kansas. What we're really trying to do is take out certain questions which have been brought before the board from any number of sources. They could possibly come from an individual school or a league of schools. They could be questions or policy proposals that might be brought forward through a member of the board of directors, the executive board themselves, or proposed by, you know, as I said, a group of schools or even one of our five organizations, the advisory organizations, which are the athletic directors, the athletic coaches, the music educators, Scholars Bowl coaches, and speech and debate communications coaches association. So it's an ongoing process. When those questions come in, they're brought before our board. Oftentimes, they're the result of surveys of groups like athletic directors or athletic coaches or music educators. And they have their own standard that typically, unless it gets 70 or 80% of their own membership support, they don't want to bring it forward. But if it does and it's brought forward, our board makes a decision about, A, do we enact a policy change or a rule change immediately? Or if not, we feel like there needs to be more widespread discussion, then they're typically sent to these regional meetings. So at a regional meeting, over the course of the next 2 weeks, I will personally go to these seven locations. And those locations include here in Topeka at the KSHSA office. On the 21st, we'll be at Fort Scott High School. October 22nd, Mill Valley High School in Shawnee, suburban Kansas City, of course. Salinas Central High School on October 23rd. And then the second week, I'm in Oakley on Monday, October 23 at the high school. Tuesday, the Dodge City Learning Center at the north end of Dodge City for Southwest Kansas schools. And we finished this year's tour in Mays for the Wichita metropolitan area in south central Kansas. And every year that order changes up a little bit so that the same people aren't always first or last. We try to be sensitive to that. The questions are, as I said, policy questions. Some might be policy changes our executive board can make. The others might be more far-reaching changes of rules in our handbook. But this is kind of an important step because it's truly a way for the executive board, through me, bringing back these what I call advisory votes on these questions by the schools, how they feel about an issue, or do they support a change or are they not. And of course, it's always a great opportunity for me to make sure I just kind of a listening opportunity, things that even aren't on the agenda that are on the mind of our schools, challenges that they're encountering. You know, it's important for us, and it's always been a real deep commitment of mine, to never lose direct contact with our member schools. Technology is wonderful, but technology can kind of put distance between us and the people we work for. And I think we have to get out there and see and be seen and remember just how far is it when a school drives from here to Oakley, Kansas, or from Fort Scott to Dodge City, you know, just to truly appreciate the state. And selfishly, I love that because I just enjoy the state. I enjoy people and getting out there and getting to see our people firsthand, shake hands, visit with people, ask about family. It's important to me. You know, we're all kind of one big statewide family.
As we get going here, the topics for discussion and what these will be is these are categorized in alphabetical order here on the agenda, no importance one way or the other. These will require votes from that certain group of people that the question is directed. So number one is it's a baseball softball question, and the question is, should we get rid of third place games for baseball and softball in the state championship series? I know this is kind of a sports medicine driven question, but what's kind of some more rationale?
Well, I think, you know, and as the baseball administrator, Jeremy, and helping with softball, you personally firsthand heard some of the concerns that we have. Typically, you know, our middle size and smaller schools are not real deep in the pitching staff. And by the time you work your way through a regional tournament and come back, you know, just a few days later and go through a state tournament where competition levels higher, you know, games are closer. Pitching staffs can really be stretched to the limits. And oftentimes, you know, if you run out of pitching, chances are you're probably not going to be the state champion team. And I think questions have been asked, understandably, for people that are playing a third place game. Not that third place isn't important and meaningful, but I think sometimes it's a struggle, as you've seen, when both teams are out of pitchers. And we're throwing kids who are position players who really haven't been pitchers. And those games can be not representative of good high school baseball played at the level that we think, you know, is deserving. Obviously, if you're in the state championship game, it probably means you got better, deeper pitching.
Right.
And that's why you're there in large part. But I think, you know, the question's a fair question. And I think also, again, as you know, there's always growing concern about overuse injury for kids. If this is an area where it would be an improvement, you know, we're not talking about any other tournaments right now other than these two sports because they're the companion sports. In softball, it isn't quite the same medical issue. You know, the mechanics of softball pitching, the rotational, you know, the internal versus external rotational pitching motion, it's a whole different situation. But what isn't different is that baseball and softball are considered to be sort of the companion sports. So you have to ask yourselves the question, and that's why we've taken it out this way, that if we would have a sense of we should take it away in baseball, do the sports both need to be treated in a consistent fashion and just eliminate them in both softballs, baseball state tournaments, even though the medical issue may not be quite the same issue for softball teams and softball pitchers specifically. So again, you know, we'll get feedback. And the only schools that will vote on this will be, of course, those schools who have baseball and softball programs at the high school level. We don't have other schools vote on this who don't have the programs. So in that sense, it's a true read for our boards. The feedback is accurate to say this is what our people think.
So those are the first two questions that we'll have with the baseball softball manager. Those were proposed by the executive board. The third question that was brought to us by Raleigh County Middle School is a topic of middle school basketball. and whether player limits for the 7th and 8th grade should be lifted in the off season.
Yeah, and Jeremy, that's kind of a very specific question. It's I describe it to people as we want to look at this as if you were a surgeon working with a very fine scalpel trying to modify or ask the question about modifying a rule in a very specific way for a very limited amount of time, as opposed to going at this with a meat axe and just throwing out the whole rule, because we think the rule still makes sense. But we have a lot of junior highs. Some of the difference in junior high versus high school sports: middle school, junior highs don't have the same consistent seasons across the state of Kansas. And our junior high rule in the handbook, Rule 8, talks about there is no season of sport defined for middle junior high schools. They don't have postseason, so consequently there isn't that end of year tournament to drive when does everybody's schedule need to end and then when does everybody's schedule need to start. It isn't unusual for middle school and junior high teams to have separate boy-girl basketball seasons opposite each other. Some don't do that. Some play concurrently, just like high schools do. And a lot of times it has to do with facilities. But in this case, they're Riley County Middle School and the league they belong to, the Mideast League. There is a separate girls' season for basketball, and it turns out to be a shorter season, if you will, in the total amount of time young ladies could be involved practicing basketball. They're going to have the same number of games as boys. It isn't about games. It's about the length of time that they're able to practice as a junior high or middle school team. Because when your season is short and it's over quickly, then you come under the three-player limit rule thereafter. And, of course, that creates an inequity. To be brutally honest, it creates, in my mind, an inequity for those schools. Now, for some schools, this is not an issue. And so what we're trying to do is carve a very narrow change in the rule, or ask the schools if they see this and believe that it would be an appropriate change to make, to try to give those all schools during certain weeks of the basketball season, regardless of the schedule of your format, and simply say during these weeks, this block of time, this window of time, the three-player basketball player limit on a non-school team rule simply would not apply. And that would have the effect of removing, if you will, the inequity that we see for girls' programs in schools that have split seasons and have a shorter season for girls in terms of how long, how many weeks of practice they can have the school team together, understanding full well they're going to play the same number of games as the boys did. So it's one of those things that if it's your school and your situation, you see the problem. And if you're not, you kind of think, well, we don't see a problem. I don't know what the fuss is about. But it does impact a lot of schools, probably a third, maybe 40% of our junior high middle schools across the state might have separated girls-boys seasons, and we think it's an important thing to try to go out and talk about and see if we can find a better solution.
Moving on to the next question, and this is a bowling topic, and it's brought forth by the Kansas Coaches Association, and this has to do with state tournament time and regional tournaments, whether we do two different tournaments within the state tournament, I guess, is what they're saying, and have an individual bowling and a Baker format bowling, which is more of a team concept, and it's what they do at the collegiate level. In other words, five bowlers will bowl two frames each, and that team score is denounced a team championship.
Yeah, exactly, you're right. It's a good description. It's almost a tournament within the tournament. You know, currently we have a tournament where a champion is crowned on the basis of all the team members and their individual scores compiled into a team score of total pinfall. And that's worked well, and we have 90 schools, I think, or close to 80 schools, I believe Cheryl told me, bowling. So it's been good. But, you know, for the last several years, there's been a growing interest in primarily bowling coaches, as you said, because this is how the college game is done in this Baker format. So they wanted five Baker games after we do our three individual games. And the reality is schools don't own, and we don't own, bowling centers. So how much time we can acquire a bowling center for usage is one issue. How much time schools can afford to allow their kids and coaches to leave school to go bowl a longer tournament day in the regular season Because I think our people understand, rightly so, that whatever we do in postseason kind of trickles back into and drives the regular season competition format, because people want to be ready for what's going to be a postseason, regional and state. So this was kind of a compromise. The executive board took this coach's recommendation from the bowling coaches, modified it slightly to 3 Baker games. So as I read it here, after the individuals would bowl 3 their games, then there would be 3 Baker games, and the total pinfall from the Baker format, where bowlers alternate, you know, basically each bowler bowls 2 frames, I think, for a composite team score. Right. And after 3 of those games, you'd crown a team champion, if you will, for first, second, third, fourth place as teams. And then you'd have other individual champions, if you will, from those earlier lines. So that plus the other change, I think, that's happening in bowling, which isn't a question here, we've already implemented, is we'll be bringing more bowlers from, I think, the 5 through 1A tournament, so that we have roughly equivalent numbers of kids making the state tournament field in both 6A and 5 through 1A. Just as an aside, we're just 1 or 2 schools away from being able to separate 5A from the 4, 3, 2, 1A. So if there would be a combination of some schools adding bowling in the next year or two, you could look for us to have 3 bowling classification championships, not just the 2. So just kind of an FYI.
Yeah. It's good to know. Moving on, the next one's a golf question, and this comes from the KIAAA. This question, I don't think, is a new question. It's been addressed and looked at for several years over the years, and it's more now you can offer advice from green to tee. This is from, can we offer advice to golfers from tee to green?
Yeah, and just to put a clarification to that, Jeremy, you're right. Not too many years ago, we did not allow coaching at all during the play of competition. And coaches felt that, you know, well, we might as well not be here if we can't coach our athletes. Or, you know, I think the historic position had been, you know, you coach your kids in practice, and when it comes time for competition, part of the game of golf is the ability to make appropriate club selection and figure distances and monitor and control one's own emotional reactions and literally be in charge of your own game. You know, it's a game of honor and the application of rules. But, you know, there's over the years been, I think, growing interest in and trying to help young people learn the game and know the rules of the game and not interfere with play, but try to provide coaching. So for several years now, we've had coaching from when we hole out on the green till we walk to the next tee box. That period between the holes has been the coaching time frame that's been acceptable. This question seeks the exact opposite. This was kind of field tested with our blessing at one large invitational tournament. The coaches there thought they liked it. There are some concerns by some about if coaches get too involved, it slows play down. If coaches get too involved, it takes the game out of the hands of the kids, and the game is supposed to be for the kids, and you have the ability to coach them in practice. You know, we'll see. It is, as you said, the way the college game is conducted, where coaches can be on the course and coach athletes. You know, it puts expectations on coaches then, and can you see all your kids and give all your kids equal advice? And is somebody unhappy because you didn't coach my child enough as you coach somebody else's child too much? And, you know, so there's always those issues. But this basically would reverse the coaching time from once we tee off. Now I can coach you as we play the hole up to the green, and then you get to the green, we leave you alone, you know, and we coach you during your active play, I guess, rather than the dead time between holes. So you're exactly right. It is obviously a high school golf question only, just like the bowling question, the baseball. Only schools that have the sport are voting on those particular questions. And, of course, then those votes come back, and they serve as a guide. They're not the final determinant, right, but they serve as a guide. It's like a sampling poll, if you will.
Yeah. And just like you said, they have the sport to vote on, and this next topic is a wrestling question, and this is just for senior high. And I think the next question is a junior high wrestling question. So this first one has to deal with participation in duels and when they can start and how many they can do a week.
Yeah, this came as a proposal from athletic directors, but really originated in Northwest Kansas. I think there are some schools there who obviously travel sometimes out of state to wrestling competitions. And by our handbook rules, for many years, you know, because of the concern of lost school time, there were some stipulations in the rule about when tournaments could begin, what days of the week. And effectively, in simplified terms, you know, this rule change would allow tournaments that are now limited to only Friday and Saturday to be moved forward, if you will, to take place on Thursday and Friday, thereby, in the eyes of some, freeing up some weekend time where maybe you weren't out every Saturday coaching athletes in wrestling tournaments. And I understand that. However, the flip side of that is there will still be those concerns about kids and athletes, coaches, needing to leave school on Thursday and Friday, both school days in some instances, barring a vacation or something. And I think people are understandably still always very interested in how much time we allow kids and coaches to be gone. You know, students missing class is certainly an important issue. A teacher coach missing class is an important, probably even a more important issue. Because if you're that teacher coach, your absence impacts every single student in all of your classes, not just the boys or girls on your particular sports team that went with you. And I think our schools, Kansas is the only state still that does a survey each four-year cycle to monitor the total loss of school time from our school attendance based on our activities. And that is posted on our website under new topics information for people to see. And it's interesting. It may be significantly less time than people think. But, you know, any time away from school is valuable time lost. And I think that's going to be some of the discussion on this issue. But effectively, this is a little bit of a shift on days of the week and time of day that would allow high school wrestling to move some things from a Friday-Saturday more to a Thursday-Friday. And then the junior high issue, if we just kind of transition right to that one, as you said, it is correct that it would be a junior high only. And again, this same Northwest Kansas area of schools, if you're a school with halves that has large numbers of kids out for wrestling and you're maybe disproportionately a bigger team than the schools you're competing with, you come together, and our wrestling scheduling is done on a point system, as wrestling people probably know. Junior high on point system. So if you came together and had what we used to call a triple dual, that used three of your allowable points. And sometimes kids would come to triple duels and not get matches because not everybody had a wrestler at the right weight for this particular youngster. Or I have so many on my team, I can't get matches for everybody because everybody else has wrestled there too, and I still have kids that haven't wrestled. And in junior high, middle school wrestling, it's very common practice for kids to kind of be matched up on sort of an estimation about the same size, and we wrestle. We've even had people in these events wrestle the same two wrestlers a second time, just to get kids more competition opportunities when you have a school with lots of wrestlers and schools with not so many. So they've done some creative things. And they call them, I think, informally these, quote, get-togethers. Right. And I believe what they're asking us is there a way that we could have these get-togethers and have wrestlers wrestle but not be charged with so many points? And again, it's probably the art of compromise. That makes sense on some level. But if you don't put some limitations on it, it could be a situation where people are actually adding to the number of events they schedule and adding to the time that they're away from school for kids and coaches. So again, I think there's nobody better than the schools themselves to kind of look at that and look at the pros and look at the cons and say, when it all comes down to it, how do we feel about that? And would this change be a helpful thing, or would it be perhaps doing unforeseen harm, more harm than good? So that's why we go out to these regional meetings. Yeah.
And this next group of questions are not sport specific, but they are more of a general topic. And that starts with a class. This will be for Class 1A only. For years, they've been grouped together. Or this will be the fifth year of dividing Class 1A. So the question now, is it time to put those Class 1A back together?
That's correct. You know, this is a fairly bold question. Some people may think, you know, we thought this was all done and it was done forever, and nothing's ever done forever. Ever since we made the change, this will be the fifth year of competition with two divisions of Class 1A. There has been a constant dialogue by those who felt it was never a good change to have made in the first place, and those who feel like, yeah, it's the right thing and we should not change this back. And, you know, nobody ever really wanted to come forward and say, well, let's put it out there and ask the schools. So our board felt like, you know, it's time to do that. There are pros and cons, obviously, as with all these things. If you look at the competition, equitable competitiveness of our state championship tournament fields, there have been teams that arguably, you know, who's to decide who's deserving of making state. But win-loss records, there are some teams with questionable records that get to the state tournament. One of the things that in the old Class 1A system that we're putting back in front of the people here is we had a two-tiered tournament eliminator, if you will. Regional tournaments, if you were a top two finishing team, you both went on to the sub-state. And that was frankly a competition format everybody else would have loved to have had. It means you could lose and still stay alive. But it was necessary because of the extra number of schools in 1A. There were 100 plus schools, give or take. So you had to have another elimination round of tournaments, to put it in simple terms. So with two teams advancing, then you'd separate those two teams to different sub-states. It's conceivable that two neighbor teams that might be close together would both have the ability to go away from one another, be together initially, you beat me, but we're both going on to sub-state, not at the same place. You'll win your tournament, you get to go to state, but so do I. And depending on how the seeds come based on win-loss records and win percentage, we might be in opposite halves of the bracket, and those same two neighboring schools might win, you know, meet up in a state championship final. People felt like that was the best possible scenario that 1A schools could have. It gave strong teams the ability to stay in the competition longer, and arguably over time, teams with better records, composite, you know, state tournament fields were stronger. The geography and the demographics of 1A schools, in the last 5 years, what's continued to happen is we've lost a few more schools. Obviously, this year, Baileyville B&B School is closing, or was closed, so that's a big absence, but there have been others where 1A schools have been absorbed. But here's the thing that's kind of an invisible thing that to some people. You know, it isn't the school district that closed, but we have a lot of 1A schools, for example, I think in volleyball or basketball. With about 100 1A schools, we only were able to field 84 basketball teams. Oftentimes, two schools have to come together and form one team from those two schools. So it isn't that we have 100 schools with 100 teams. We might have now 95 schools left, and we've got 80 or 85 teams out of those 95 to 100 schools. So the numbers of schools are diminishing. The total student population in 1A is probably growing smaller just through the natural demographic changes of small towns in Kansas. It's at least a question that we feel is worth asking, and we'll see how 1A schools, obviously only 1A schools, will vote on it.
Right. And the next question has to do with kind of more of an administrative role within the schools and whether transportation should be allowed for summer athletic camps, clinics, or contests.
Yeah, through the years, the association's policy has been, and it was because our member schools wanted it to be this way. We have prevented Kansas schools from using their school-owned transportation to transport kids to summer athletic competitions, camps, clinics, 7-on-7, et cetera, et cetera. Again, that goes back to a time where school people told us they felt like the school activities program during the school year is their responsibility and their financial responsibility. Outside of that, that should be, in the summertime, ought to be the responsibility of the families and the parents and the kids who want to do these, what I guess I'd call enrichment kinds of activities. Obviously, in the modern era of youth sports and the culture that is so involved with summer involvement with athletics, camps, off-season programs, etc., competitions, you know, combines, camps, 7-on-7, whatever form it takes, AAU, MAYB, there are schools who have approached us and said, you know, we would like the ability to make that decision for ourselves. We've found that that's a very difficult policy to monitor, police, and enforce. Some schools own their buses and thereby, if they abide by the rule, don't use them to transport kids. Some schools don't own buses. It's a lease arrangement. And so their teams, coaches, and families can lease from the same bus company. And here sits a school bus that's a leased bus, and somebody else said, we didn't drive our bus. It looks like it's inconsistently applied. So I think it only stands to reason to take the question back to schools and simply say, do you want to decide this for yourself? We hear that schools make decisions locally about, do we let our buses be used by summer groups for park and recreation activity trips, for church groups going to a church summer camp, leasing a school bus, paying the district for the use of it, the driver, the fuel, etc. And I think the logic here is just to say to schools, tell us what you want us to do. We understand, you know, why they wanted us to be the bad guy and say, you can't use your own buses. But what that also leaves is sometimes scenarios which are frankly quite risky, where young people might be driving themselves, or a carload of high school kids driving to a summer 7-on-7 or a summer tournament or a summer coaching camp or clinic. And that presents other dangers that most parents of teenagers would probably prefer. If my sons and daughters were on a school bus with a driver that's trained, licensed, and I'm willing to pay for a cost for my child to be on the seat of the bus, if that's what it takes. Okay. So this policy is just to let the schools tell us what they want to do.
And if we look at these next four questions, that they're brought from our executive board, and they're more dealt with health and wellness of our coaches and students, and some sportsmanship issues as well. And the first one is, should we require coaches to take the heat and illness course from the NFHS?
Right. There is a free online course, which is an excellent course. There are a number of free courses through our National Federation of State High School Associations. Their website has literally a catalog of some are free courses, some are pay-per-use courses, but they're all excellent. They're very timely, they're current, and we believe that obviously you can never provide probably enough training. We've always been reluctant to try to put an unfunded mandate on schools, but it's hard to argue that there's an unfunded mandate when the resource available for the training is absolutely free. And what we think makes good sense is that the course for heat and hydration, for anybody who coaches athletics, you know, particularly those sports that are outdoor sports in the fall and even the spring, it's important to understand, you know, heat, hydration, humidity, and all those factors and the warning signs for young people to indicate heat illness, heat stress, heat stroke, and prevent serious injury and or fatality. It's not like we've had a terrible statistical outbreak of this. No, we haven't. But you never want to let your guard down. You never want to quit trying to be better and more knowledgeable and better informed. And our position in asking the question is simply based on that. It's for the safety of students, you know, first and foremost. You can never do enough, I don't think. And in Kansas, we have coaches who come from the ranks of being certified as a teacher. It doesn't mean that I have a lot of biology background or kinesiology or anatomy or anything else. You know, teachers, only if their district might require in services in things like first aid, safety, CPR, you know, we don't have those requirements. So we think these are maybe some common sense things that might be easy to do and literally at no cost to the schools. It's just a commitment of about a half hour of time. And we would hope that anybody that wants to coach and spend hundreds of hours coaching a season with kids, one more half hour on the front end of that wouldn't be a whole lot more to commit if it's going to help you be a safer, more knowledgeable coach to watch out for your young people. So I think that's the gist of that one.
And then the next one, the right after that, is the kind of the same question for concussions. Should we require coaches to get more educated about concussions?
And again, this is a free course. In 2011, I believe it was, the Kansas legislature enacted basically a policy that we had already created. It became the law for the state of Kansas that says, you know, here's what we do with concussion. And part of that is to educate parents and coaches, but also the players themselves. So our proposal on this question is that within the first 3 days of their practice season, the coaches and the members of the team as a team activity, just like we're going to go in and watch film of next week's opponent. We take 30 minutes, a half hour of our practice, and we go in and we watch and work through this question answer concussion course, which is free, as a team. And by doing that, instead of goofing around, poking each other and not paying attention, by doing that, coaches and athletes both can be alert to watching not just my players, but maybe my teammate. Because sometimes the kids in the huddle have a much better understanding if Gary Musselman's been hit and he doesn't know, he's not oriented, he can't remember, he's having trouble maintaining balance. The guys in the huddle with Gary are much more likely to spot that than coach over here 50 feet away on a sideline. And get him out of here, coach. You know, Musselman, you got to get out of here. You go over there and we'll get somebody in here. It's not safe for me. It's not a good situation for anybody. So we want to teach everybody the same skill set by having this be a team activity. And I think it's a really simple, easy thing for people to do. And again, it's not going to cost one penny.
The next question, and again brought by the executive board, in soccer, if you get ejected or get a red card, you have to sit out the next game. So basically what we're thinking is, maybe should that be the case for every sport? If a player or coach gets ejected, should they have to sit out for that next game?
Jeremy, this is a question we've asked over the years a couple of times, and schools have always told us, well, we'd kind of like to handle that ourselves. Let's don't have a statewide rule. The reason it was put in soccer years ago is because soccer came into our system as not a school-originated sport. It came from the club world. And there were some concerns about, frankly, the attitude of soccer players and parents and behavior. And so it had a stricter, tougher rule. This year to date, talking to David Cherry of our staff, I think we've had about 28 player ejections in soccer. Some are more severe than others. We've had in football, Mark Lentz told me yesterday, 61 players this year to date, 10 coaches this year to date. You know, this is our year. We put in place a requirement that if you're a coach and you're ejected, you take $20 course. You're not allowed to coach again until you complete the $20, 45-minute online course called the Teaching and Modeling of Behavior, which is just a good reminder for coaches of what it is we're here to do at this level. And it's not about winning and losing at the cost of the dignity of young people. You're not being paid to coach kids, to abuse kids, to curse kids, to mentally, emotionally be cruel to kids. Okay? There are some things more important than whether we win or lose on a scoreboard, and it's the experience of the kids. So I think, in part, you know, we use an expression around this office, what we permit is what we promote. And if we're going to permit bad behavior, we're going to permit conduct that results in 60 or 80 kids being ejected, there needs to be some consequence. But more importantly, it needs to be consistent. And sometimes schools who've never dealt with this, when it happens, frankly, struggle with to know, what do we do? Or if a coach gets ejected, what do we do? So by having a rule that would be consistent for everybody, there's no ifs, ands, or buts, here's what you do. You take the class. And you sit down and have that conversation and say, this is it. And if it happens a second time, there'll probably be a more serious consequence. It's just exactly what schools do, you know, with any other kind of disciplinary problem. Because frankly, we all know, and we live by the standard, that these activity programs are an extension of the classroom. They are a learning laboratory. It's a teaching opportunity for kids, as well as the coaches who are teachers. And frankly, we want to make sure that our programs represent what Kansas people want them to represent and what Kansas taxpayers feel like. Those dollars are invested in teaching young people lifelong lessons, giving them experiences that are meaningful, not a license to go out and act badly and not be held accountable. And this isn't overly harsh, you know, for a youngster or a coach to say, you're going to have to sit out the rest of the game, you got ejected. You're going to have to sit out any other game between now and the time that you coach again or play again at this level. So you're going to sit the rest of the game, you're ejected, the next game at the same level, and any other game in between. If you were scheduled to be a JV player tomorrow night before the next varsity game a week from now, you're not going to get to participate in those games. We've done that in soccer for years. The schools have handled it. And here's the thing that listeners need to know. a lot of schools, and even more importantly, several of our leagues across the state have already adopted this position years ago. And again, you know, we're preaching to the choir because they're already there. But the point is, the concern comes when we do that, but our opponent team lacks the will to do that because they're more interested in having that kid play and maybe winning that game than the more important lesson of what do these programs represent and what do we stand for. So again, it goes back to the philosophy of being education-based sports and the lessons, and part of those lessons are behaviors, emotional control, regulating oneself, whether you're successful or whether you're unsuccessful, and not defining your worth by the outcome of a scoreboard. Because if that were the case, fully half of the kids in Kansas, every time we have games Friday nights, walk off the field as losers. That doesn't define them to be losers or bad people. And so we don't want to define our programs and sit by and sort of hope everybody's going to do something, but in the meantime, we don't, or what we do is inconsistent. So we think this gives an opportunity for at least a conversation about consistency and a very simple and a very easily administered consequence. It's very specific. You know, we think it has a lot of potential value that way.
And then the next one kind of stems off of that. You mentioned that coaches have to take a course now if they're ejected. And this is for the player now. If a player were to get ejected, well, there's a 15-minute course, free sportsmanship course.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you said the key word. It's free. It's 15 minutes. Frankly, you know, for me to sit down and conference with one of my players who'd been ejected from a contest is going to take about the same amount of time. And I'm not going to suggest as a coach, because I was a coach and I had to do that, I'm not going to suggest coach not conference with a player or the athletic director or both. But I'm thinking as part of that would be, this is a very easy thing to do because kids are so technologically competent. And again, it's free. There's no cost to the young person. There's no cost to his or her school. It is just a bit of a reminder and a wake-up call that, you know, here's what we're here to do. And you may have got caught up in the winning or the losing, or you may have got caught up in the passion or the heat of the moment and done something that was ill-advised, and maybe you even regret it. But this is an opportunity to kind of take a step back and sort of redirect, get squared away, and bring you right back here, and unless there's some other consequence the school needs or wants to impose. And they're certainly free to do that. We're just talking about some basic fundamental things that would happen with kids that would be similar to what we were asking coaches to do now. And again, it's all about trying to promote through our actions, not just cheap talk, that our programs need to always be educational and educationally based. If they're not, I'm not sure we should justify the effort, the time, the expense that we put into them. Because communities in Kansas and schools care deeply about these teams. You know, it's such big news. It's such a proud moment to win a uniform, to go play for my school, to see the community turn out, to support us. That's still a big, big, big thing in Kansas, and I hope it always will be. But if we don't continue to uphold the principles of what we stand for, we stand to lose the credibility of these programs, and we stand to lose the respect of the people who support them. And that would not be appropriate.
And the last question to vote on for our schools will be, should the KSHSAA adopt the following as an addition to the Handbook Rule 11 with athletic officials, and that has to deal with an assault and battery rule for the people involved in our activities. And we've seen this happen throughout the nation as far as officials getting attacked on the field or on the court, and frankly, some very serious injuries resulting in that.
Well, and not only that, Jeremy, but some fatalities. You know, fortunately, I guess, not that there's anything fortunate about a sports official who dies from being punched, and that's happened on more than one occasion in the last 2 years. At least it did not occur in the context of a high school sports setting. And we've not had that, but you don't want to wait till you have it to think, whoops, we probably should have put something in place. Again, I think our schools understand and take very seriously their responsibility to secure competent game officials and to protect and ensure the safety of those individuals and to keep them from the passions and perhaps the emotional lack of control that some fans, I hesitate to call them that, might show, who get way too wound up in this and forget what we're truly about. But, you know, we had our attorney draft this language about assault and battery and what would define each, and felt that, you know, there is no law in the state of Kansas right now that deals with this, but we can't write the law. We don't control the legislature, but we can control what we do as a governing body and say these are things that will be acceptable and these are things that wouldn't be. And frankly, because of the increasing emotional volatility of some youth sports programs and school sports programs, the emotion of people sometimes getting out of control, I think you have to think proactively. And again, as a school, if you ever had a situation, to have the ability to know this is exactly what we have to follow, this is the remedy, these are the steps we take, to have that laid out very clearly would be helpful. So you wouldn't be left on your own to sort of grasp at straws to think, well, I don't know what we're supposed to do now.
Right.
Do we call the county attorney? Do we have them press charges? You know, what do we do? If that behavior is by a player, you know, what our proposal here is about players and coaches. That if you're a participant and you've committed assault and battery on an official during or after a competition, you'll be ineligible for that sport for the remainder of that season. And that's it, postseason included. You're done. There's no second chance. There's no, well, you know, he didn't mean it, we're going to let him keep playing. You're done. Part B talks about a coach who would determine to have committed assault and battery on a sports official would not be permitted to coach for the remainder of the season, and that would include the postseason. Again, you know, some might argue, I don't need the association to have this rule. We're the employer of this coach. Will take this action without the benefit of the rule needing to be there. And I would tell you that I'm sure that's true in a lot of cases. But I think in some cases there might be pushback, there might be resistance by some who thinks, well, give coach a second chance where something he did or she did was so egregious, you shouldn't. And frankly, they could be looking at criminal charges, so they ought not to be coaching our children. Again, the lesson is, the important takeaway is, what is the example we want to put in front of very impressionable young people? Do we want an adult leading young people who can't emotionally control themselves to the point that they can't resist putting hands on or verbally assaulting or threatening an official to a point that it would literally be a criminal act? And it's sad that you have to even ask these kinds of questions, but I think it's important that we do, before we have anything that would develop that would be a very serious situation like we've seen take place in other parts of the country.
Right. And we certainly have seen that. And moving on, and this is, the questions are going to be over at this point. The last thing on the agenda, and I know this could be a completely different podcast. We talk about this for hours, but it's a general just discussion item with the heat acclimatization guidelines that we currently have, and if those need to be adjusted to become longer or shorter, or what the discussion will be.
Yeah, basically the idea here is we just want to take a look. You know, we talked about that course that we're considering, should coaches take the heat and hydration course. As a part of that continuing, always ongoing effort to look at all of our practices of what do we permit, you know, when do we start, how much time do we allow kids to essentially train up? Because you can't just start day one of practice in school on Monday of standard calendar week 7 and go full tilt. The sports scientists would tell you, the medical people would tell you, that it takes about 2 weeks for kids to become fit and acclimated to heat and humidity, particularly in the August time of year when we start our sports. And it's not just football players, it's cross-country kids, it's soccer kids, it's girls in gymnasiums that may not be air-conditioned playing volleyball. So it's all of our sports. So we tried to take a look at all of our rules for our fall sports and ask ourselves the question, would there be things that we might do differently? Should we have some changes in those rules about how much practice we permit or how we structure practices? Should there be time limits? Should there be no back-to-back days when you'd have multiple days of multiple practices, like a two-a-day practice? If you had two-a-day practice, should they be limited and structured so that one would not be, you know, a physical type practice, but more of a mental walkthrough teaching kind of practice. You know, these are things, and we're looking at some of the guidelines from the National Athletic Trainers Association. These are the gold standard, you know, so you want to look at what's the best, what do we currently do, and is there some gap there that we should begin to try to narrow the gap, not necessarily go all the way to the gold standard, but, you know, you're trying to look to see what would be your best practices. And then, of course, the other question that sort of transitions into another sort of a philosophical discussion has to do with similar things, only it has to do with head injury and concussion and the ability of high school athletes, particularly football players, to be exposed to head trauma and the growing concern about potential future head trauma for young people who accumulate through contact in practice hundreds and hundreds of what doctors call subconcussive hits. It isn't the one big hit or the neck snap that causes the concussion. We understand concussion. People can diagnose that. But the part that's equally troubling is the concern about kids who have contact, you know, through a long football season. And then maybe we go to summer camps and we go to summer, you know, combines and we're hitting, we're trying to win that scholarship, impress those coaches or win a spot on my team. And, you know, some states, not Kansas, thankfully, we don't have spring football. There's a handful of states who do. But literally there are young people across the country who are subjected to hitting and head contacts for three-fourths of the year or more. And some of those kids might double in the wintertime as a wrestler and be subject to those kind of bumps and, you know, dings again. So the National Federation put together a 28-person special task force, mostly medical people. I was privileged to be asked to serve on that committee as a member of the National Federation's Board of Directors and came away with, just this last week, as a National Fed board member, we approved the final report out of that committee. Brent Unruh of our staff serves on the National Fed Sports Medicine Committee as a certified athletic trainer. So Brent has had input in this as well. So we want to put this in front of our schools. And again, for the purpose of having them read it, analyze it, discuss it, and eventually before next year, ask ourselves some questions about, do we need to look at some of our practices in football and allow maybe or build into our rules some kind of definition about how long any one practice might be or how many days of contact or how many hours or what percentage of a practice might be a contact practice. Just as an example, I've listed on our regional meetings agenda, several states, you know, have already gone ahead and enacted. And these are states where high school football is a very serious business.
Right.
You can start with Texas and Alabama. Had coaches from both states on this group, or Alabama with us, Oklahoma coach, California coach. And to a person, the coaches that I've talked to said, you know, if you put in place a restriction that said 33% of our practice time in a week could be contact and not more than that, if you define contact the way USA Football does, and we put that in our proposal or our information here as thud, which means we're hitting, we're just not taking people to the ground, but that's hitting.
Right.
And then if we're full contact, live action, we're hitting and we're taking you to the ground. Anything that's not those two things isn't considered contact. Those two things, most football coaches would tell you, and I've had Kansas coaches tell me this, Gary, we're not doing that much hitting right now because we know we can't beat ourselves up and be ready to go on Friday, or I don't have enough kids on my squad to hit that much and beat ourselves up. We're trying to keep enough bodies healthy to make sure our team is ready to play or able to play. So I'm not sure it would be this monumental change that people might first think. And I think it's one of those things, unfortunately, none of us can predict the future and what the physical well-being of today's high school players is going to be 20 years from now. But the medical science is growing and the research and the data is becoming very much more compelling and clear that there is a correlation. You know, you're seeing that in the NFL studies. We're seeing the collegiate level put in some of these measures, these safeguards. You're not trying to take the hitting out of football. Football's a great game. Football's a safe game when it's played right. We've made rule changes in football. Equipment standards have improved in football. Football participation numbers at the high school level are on the rise. They're not on the decline. So there isn't this hidden agenda about trying to do away with high school football. I want to put that to bed right away. This is trying to make football and any other sport that we have safer for young people, not just in the immediate term, but in their future, for their own physiological health when their playing days are over, so that they're not suffering chronic encephalopathy like we see some of the longtime NFL players or people in the military who've been subject to those explosive concussive head type injuries. So you're just trying to do proactive work. And again, we're seeing benefits from states, even in the first year where they've made these changes. They've seen reductions in the number of head injuries and concussions by their athletes. It obviously doesn't eliminate it, because concussions and injury happen more statistically more often in games than in practice. But if you can try to address this kind of subtle, quiet, accumulative effect of the repeated concussive blows, subconcussive blows, that's a big, big piece of this whole overarching thing.
Well, Gary, that's a pretty full agenda. You know, you have 14 questions to vote yes or no on, and two good discussion items for administrators to get together and talk about. Certainly going to be worth their while to make it out there to this regional meetings, and we'll get started here Monday, October 20th, here in the office.
Yeah, I just, in closing, Jeremy, would tell you that, you know, this is my 19th year to be the executive director, and I served as an assistant for 8 years prior. I don't recall ever that we've had a regional meeting agenda with this much content, this many significant and what I guess I'd call meaty questions. And I think that as member schools of the association, there is every reason for them to make certain that they're represented at the meeting. Obviously, each school has the ability to cast one vote on these questions if they have the sport at issue. And some of these questions, it'll be junior high and middle school, as well as high school people voting on the questions about ejected players, assault and battery of officials, you know, not just the girls' basketball question. So there's more here for middle, junior, high school people as well as high school people. So we're hoping to see lots of athletic directors, principals, superintendents are welcome, members of local boards of education are welcome. There's no secrets here. The agenda is public. It's on our website. It's been there since the 1st of October. And, you know, the idea here, we give it to them in advance with specific intent. They'll talk about it with staff. They'll talk about it in their league. They'll talk about it in their school board meetings. And their representative will come to those meetings and cast a vote that is representative of that school's position on these questions. And I don't know how you can get more democratic than that. And I don't know how you can be more open and more inclusive than that. So, again, that goes back to those who would say that, well, the association never changes its rules, or it makes its rules in some secret way that nobody understands or nobody gets to be involved. There's, you know, this dictatorship thing, when the reality is nothing can be further from the truth. This is absolutely democracy as a participatory sport, you know.
Yeah.
As an old coach and government teacher, I'm happy because that's the way it functions best. So we hope to see a good crowd, and thank you for letting us talk about these issues.
Thank you.
Copies of that agenda are online at Kaysha.org. Go ahead and find that. You can read the questions for yourself to see what the administrators will be voting on. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of the podcast as we cover the Regional Administrative Board agenda meeting, and we'll see you out there.